Wolfgang Sawallisch at the piano. And that's it for today's programme. It was great that you could join me. Next week, as promised, Stravinsky takes centre stage. And from 10, that's from 10 o'clock. And my double concerto is by Brahms in another classic recording, this time conducted by Ferenc Fritschei, who, as I said earlier, died 50 years ago this year. His soloists, Wolfgang Schneiderhan and Janosch Starker. So please do join me, same time, 9 o'clock, here on Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
As part of BBC Radio 3's Baroque Spring, a series of five live Sunday concerts on Radio 3, placing Baroque music in its historical context. It's the opportunity to experience the music of the 17th and 18th centuries in new light through performances at five properties, each with their own strong links to the Baroque period. Join me, Katie Derham, with Antiques Roadshow's Lars Tharp, Sundays at 2 o'clock on BBC Radio 3. Go online and search for Baroque Spring to find out more.
Yes, and the first of those live concerts is at 2 o'clock this afternoon from the 18th century stone gallery of the Vine in Hampshire. That's Baroque Spring Live at 2. And before it, Catherine Bott will be launching our Baroque Spring in today's early music show, which comes live from Media City, UK, in Salford. That's just after the 1 o'clock news. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now a minute after 12 midday. Time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Jared Diamond is the best-selling anthropologist whose books include Collapse and Guns, Germs and Steel. His new book is The World Until Yesterday. In comparing, Jared, the ways of tribal cultures, you invite us to look at our own behaviour in the light of theirs and see what we can learn. But it also seems to me, I don't know if you would entirely agree with this, that you suggest along the way that human beings continue to make the same mistakes over and over again.
I would say that human beings continue to face the same problems over and over again, which inevitably means the same mistakes and the same successes. Areas in which we can learn from traditional societies include how they bring up their children, who tend to be more socially skilled and independent than our children in industrial societies, how they treat their old people, which is variously much crueler and much more satisfying than the way we treat our old people, and then views about danger, traditional people, because they don't have doctors and police to bail them out, have to be more attentive and have to think more clearly about danger than we do. So those are just examples of some of the areas where we can learn from traditional people.
Although you talk about all kinds of cultures, Aboriginal, for example, you actually spent a lot of time in New Guinea, didn't you?
That's right. I went to New Guinea for the first time in 1964. It was love at first sight, and I'm getting ready to go back for the 27th time. The reality is, once you've been to New Guinea, the rest of the world is boring, and of course I'll keep going back.
One of the things that surfaces quite often is the resolution of conflict. There are some very fascinating pictures in the book too, which either have a meeting of elders, and then you compare that with a judge listening to two lawyers arguing in front of him. What conclusions did you come to about that?
Well, the area of conflict resolution in state governments involves third parties who are concerned with determining right or wrong, and above all other things, to prevent people taking justice into their own hands. The government does not care about whether you end up on speaking terms with your ex-wife or with your sister with whom you're involved in an inheritance dispute. In contrast, in tribal societies, the people with whom you're involved in a dispute will always be people in the neighborhood, because there are no strangers. Societies are sedentary. What counts above all is to be able to deal with that person for the rest of your life and not to be filled with hatred. So the goal in traditional dispute resolution is to restore a relationship.
I mentioned some of the illustrations, and funnily enough, one of them concerns our first composer. You say that Bach has all the appearance of a diabetic.
Yes, we don't have a good medical diagnosis for what Bach died of, but the sole portrait of him shows an individual with a rather puffy face and puffy hands. His handwriting deteriorated notably towards the end of his life, and he had problems with vision, all of which are consistent with the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is unknown among traditional societies because they're on a Spartan diet. They don't take in much salt or sugar.
I think he inspired you to play the organ, didn't he, Bach?
Oh, very directly. One of the two instantly transforming experiences in my life, the other being my first meeting with my wife. The other was being in Clare College Chapel, Cambridge, late afternoon as the sunlight was fading, for an organ recital. I had already become interested in, of course, in the music of Bach, and the organist performed from the Orgelbüchlein, Jesu meine Freude. I decided on the spot that I was going to learn to play organ. So my last year at Cambridge, although I was in physiology, I spent up to 8 hours a day playing the organ in Trinity College. I taught myself how to play the organ. My goal was to end up playing the complete organ works of Bach, and I got about one third of the way through it before I was derailed. But it all started instantly with Jesu meine Freude.
Simon Preston was playing Jesu meine Freude, the chorale prelude BWV 610 from Orgelbüchlein by Bach. And so did music continue to be a passion for you, both as a performer and as a listener, Jared?
Yes, I'm still playing chamber music today. My mother was a concert pianist, and I started playing the piano when I was 6 years old. I had fantasies of becoming a composer, but I didn't have the talent. I had fantasies of becoming a conductor, but I didn't have the talent. But I still play with great pleasure.
Actually, the whole point of your book, in one sense, is summarized for me in the fact that when we learn about how something is put together, we can relate to it in a completely different way. And I would imagine that's true for you with both the Bach and the Beethoven we're about to hear, that in playing these pieces, you listen to them with a slightly different ear.
Especially for the organ, to listen to organ music, the cool reality is usually what one hears is an uproar of sound, and one doesn't hear the voices. Even in that wonderful recording of Jesu Meine Freude, it's hard to hear the soprano line unless you already know what the soprano line is. So to be able to play organ means hearing all the parts rather than just an uproar. But it's also the case that when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and I had fantasies of becoming a professional musician, the first course that I took, the harmony course with professional musicians, was the most valuable course that I took in my life because it greatly increased my appreciation of music.
And this piece you do play, don't you, this violin sonata?
Yes, this is the most recent piece that I played, and the first piano lesson that I've had since age 16, my violinist and I took a lesson with the University of California professor for music performance. He spent an hour and a half with us, mostly on the first three pages of the first movement, because there was so much detail that he explained to us.
It's the scherzo that you've asked to hear, though. Is there something about that in particular that you love?
They're all equally wonderful.
Isaac Stern and Eugene Istomin playing Beethoven's Violin Sonata in G, Opus 96, of which that was the Scherzo Third Movement. Do you get the same kind of fun that you playing that, as I could see you smiling as you listened to the rather joyous bounce of that music?
I was smiling because my first reaction was, they play it, whoever they are, they play it better than Lisa and I played it. The tempo was just right. It had grace. And then when you told me who it was that's playing it, it's not so bad that they played it better than Lisa and I did.
I think if you could play it the same or better, then you might have made the wrong decision when you
indeed
changed direction in your life. In fact, that medical, sort of physiological start in life, quite interesting to make the change you did, because I imagine you were probably destined for academia.
I was destined for academia early on because my father was a physician. And so as I was growing up, I assumed that I would be a physician like my father, but go into medical research. When I was an undergraduate, while taking the pre-med courses, I already began research. So it was clear that I was going to go into a career in biological research.
We're going to hear another piece of Bach next, Jared Diamond, which is the St. Anne Fugue, played by Christopher Herrick. I imagine that for a scientist, and in many ways that is what you are or how you began, the organization of Bach is terribly appealing.
I would say rather than organization of Bach, because people often equate Bach with organization devoid of feeling. What appeals to me in Bach is, on the one hand, the richness and detail such that one can listen to a piece by Bach. I can listen to the opening chorus of the St. John Passion dozens of times, and I'm always hearing new things in it. And it's that richness of detail combined with the emotional power often. Not always, there's lots of dry Bach, but there's much Bach with overwhelming emotional power. On a small scale, the chorale we've heard, Jesu meine Freude, and then on a large scale, the fugue from the Klavierübung Part 3.
It's wonderful how he pulls the musical jigsaw together, isn't it?
That's such a remarkable piece. And the performance also, the piece, the sense of excitement, not just the detail, but the build-up throughout the third of the fugues, the combination of music with concepts and philosophy. With Bach, you can't understand it just as music, because there's a message. And this, a prime example, a triple fugue representing the Trinity. Both the prelude and fugue are in three parts, and they flank the Klavier Übung part three. And I thought that that performance worked well. And of course, it's among the high points of Bach's organ music.
Well, the performer was Christopher Herrick, and that was the prelude in E-flat, BWV 552, St. Anne, by Bach. Jared Diamond, we're going to hear in a moment El König, so this might be a good moment to talk a little bit about children in your book, because you make some very interesting comments about how we protect children, and we even have no-go areas in Western civilization, whereas children in some of these tribal customs are often given quite a free rein to find out for themselves.
Yeah, the view in not just New Guinea, but in traditional societies in general, is that children are autonomous creatures who, yes, they're smaller and less experienced, but their will should not be thwarted, and they should make their own decisions and learn from their mistakes. New Guineans carry it further than even I would. In New Guinea, my first year there, I noticed that New Guinea Highlanders, they all have fire scars on their arms, and I thought that they got those fire scars lighting fires as adults. But no, they get the fire scars mostly as children or infants playing next to a fire. The attitude of adults is that children have to learn from their mistakes, and if a foolish baby plays close to the fire, the baby's got to learn, not by having the adults say, don't go close to the fire. That's further than we would go, but in the United States, and I think in Europe too, parents go to the opposite extreme of micromanaging their children.
And what would you say are the results of that greater freedom?
My impression, and it's a widespread impression of Westerners who've worked in traditional societies, is that not only as adults are people more self-confident and able to operate independently, but already as children. I'm struck in New Guinea by the fact that a five-year-old kid will come up to me and negotiate. On one occasion, I remember I needed porters because our porters had deserted. We had to get everybody in the village. There weren't enough men. So there was this 10-year-old boy who volunteered to be a porter. I said, we're going off there for roughly how long? His parents weren't around, so he didn't ask their permission. When they came back to the village, they would have heard that their son had gone off with some white man and some other people in the village for it wasn't clear how long in this direction. At the end of a week, when the other porters went back, I asked him if he would stay on for several weeks to work on birds with me. And so after a week, he did not come back, but his parents took it for granted. Yeah, a 10-year-old can make his own decisions, and he'll come back sometime, wherever he is. And yes, he eventually came back. But that was an eye-opener for me to see how a 10-year-old is capable of negotiating and making his own decisions.
Clearly, they were not worried that you were the Earl König.
No.
Tell us about this song and your love of it.
The song is remarkable for several reasons. One, that Schubert wrote it at a relatively early age, the age of 18, and it's difficult to imagine the emotional profundity of this song in someone at the age of 18. It's interesting, of course, for the differentiation of the three roles. It's to a text by Goethe which differentiates a father, a child, and then a seductive spirit. And the singer has to differentiate the three roles. There's also the differentiation as the song goes on and as the drama builds up, the Erlkönig, the seductive figure, becoming more seductive, the child getting more frightened, the father attempting to comfort the child but getting concerned himself.
And then, of course, the horse.
The horse. The unbroken triplets throughout. And then in a tragedy, in Shakespearean tragedies, usually, or in the opera Don Giovanni. The opera Don Giovanni does not end with Don Giovanni being dragged down to hell and then we're thrown out onto the street shaking. Instead, there's the finale, which allows us to recover ourselves. But Erlkönig We are told the last words are, in seinem Armen das Kind war tot, the child was dead, and then bang, the last two chords, and we are thrown out onto the street, shaking.
We heard Dietrich Fischer-Dieska with Gerald Moore at the piano singing Erl König, Deutsch 328 by Schubert. One of the great attractions for you, I imagine, Jared Diamond, and in fact you sort of spoken about it elliptically in some ways, is that all music is to a certain extent theme and variation.
That's specifically true of Brahms. Brahms wrote a number of themes and variations. Not that large a number, but variations are essential to his technique of composition. Brahms is also a figure in Marie's and my life, because when I was ready to propose to my wife, Marie, I knew that Marie loved the Brahms A major intermezzo, which I had played for her. And so I was ready to propose, and I had reason to believe that I would be accepted. But one doesn't want to take chances on something big like this. And so I stayed home all day that day, practicing the A major intermezzo. And then in the evening, after we had gone to a concert, which was a disappointing concert, I said to Marie, well, the concert was disappointing, so let me play something for you. And I played the Brahms intermezzo that I practiced so diligently. And then Marie was welling up with tears, and then I turned to her and made my proposal. So Brahms plays a role in our life.
And you've chosen this piece rather than the intermezzo.
I chose this piece, the theme and variations from the sextet, for a couple of reasons. It's the passion, the intensity of it, the passion combined with the classical organization, the fact that this is early Brahms. Early Brahms was lengthy, not compressed as later Brahms, and so this sextet may be the longest of all of Brahms's chamber compositions. So this sprawling early Brahms, this is, I would say, one of the high points of sprawling early Brahms. Thank you.
Thank you.
The sextet in B-flat, opus 18, from which that was the second movement, the Andante ma moderato variations, by Brahms, played by the Raphael Ensemble. You've talked about Bach, and you've talked about your wife, and now, courtesy of the Book of Revelation, we bring the two together.
This was the piece that Marie and I chose for the processional for our wedding, the Bach cantata, Nun ist das Heil und die Kraft und das Reich und die Macht. It's a wonderful cantata. It's a single movement. We don't know what else was lost. It's for a double chorus, but it's an outstanding example of declamation, that's say matching the music to the text. If you just read the text without knowing what Bach did with it, you hear triplets. Nun ist das Heil und die Kraft und das Reich und die Macht. So Bach sets it to music in which there are three sets of triplets going up the scale. Nun ist das Heil und die Kraft und das Reich. And then Bach develops it as a intense double chorus fugue, which turns the theme upside down. It's utterly magnificent. So that was our wedding procession.
Das Heil und die Kraft, the cantata number 50, BWV 50, by Johann Sebastian Bach, the Amsterdam Baroque Choir and Orchestra, conducted by Ton Koopman. Well, Jared Diamond, we've had your wedding processional. I think we should now be allowed to hear the recessional, and we move to another Bach, don't we?
This is the Magnificat, not by Johann Sebastian Bach, but by his son C.P.E. Bach. The piece that we chose as our wedding recessional, the opening chorus of his Magnificat, is, to my mind, the best, most powerful composition by C.P. Bach. It's exciting.
I think this was quite some wedding.
For many reasons.
That was the opening chorus of the Magnificat by C.P.E. Bach. We heard the Geschinger Kantorei of Stuttgart with the Stuttgart Bach Collegium, directed by Helmut Rilling. Well, up until now, we have stuck fairly closely with the classical period. We moved on to Brahms, of course. But now we are going to undoubted romantic piece of music.
There's a lot that rides, for me, on this last piece, one of the four last songs by Richard Strauss. One of the chapters of my book is about aging, the differences in old age in our modern society, which is often miserable compared with traditional societies where old people still have a function, particularly as the repositories of information. The last songs by Richard Strauss, written at age 84, they're in a different style from his early works. And Strauss was introspective. He described to his later librettist, Stefan Zweig, the changes in his musical abilities with age. He said that with age, he was incapable of producing the tone poems, the absolute music, the long, sprawling themes that he had written earlier in life. But he told Zweig, but I can instead still be inspired by the word. This was a song which 40 years ago I would have found it difficult to listen to without crying. Now I've got a little more perspective on it, and I can listen to it, but it's still a very moving piece, the last composition of a great composer, and probably, I would say, also the greatest composition of his last several decades. That's an 84-year-old who was not going to produce a 15-minute song, a 4-minute song with no repetition, every measure different from the previous measure. At that age, he didn't have the energy to write longer, but he could distill it. That's the Chateau d'Yquem of music.
And the wonderful Gundula Janowitz singing there with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Herbert von Karajan in Frühling, from the Four Last Songs by Richard Strauss. You mentioned Stefan Zweig, a really great writer in my view. He had to flee the Nazis, and very sad because Zweig couldn't face old age in exile and jointly committed suicide with his wife.
That's right. He and his wife emigrated to Argentina, where they committed suicide together. I have to ask myself, was it a voluntary on both sides? Or I don't know their relationship. Was Zweig the stronger figure, and did he persuade or pressure his wife against her will? Who knows? But at any rate, you're right that this was a person who could not cope with the world around him. But on the other hand, Stefan Zweig faced a bleak, a more horrible world in 1942 than Strauss did in 1948.
Jared Diamond, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jared Diamond talking to Michael Barclay. This month, Radio 3 is celebrating a Baroque spring, if you haven't already heard. And next week on Private Passions, there's another chance to hear the crime writer, Donna Leon, talking to Michael about her passion for the music of that period. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall. Well, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome from me, Ian Skelly, to the first full day of Radio 3's new season, Baroque Spring, if you've recently tuned this way. It's live music from the Baroque all the way this afternoon. In a couple of minutes, we'll be crossing live to the BBC studios in Salford for a special edition of the Early Music Show. The English Concert provides performances of music by Handel, Bach, Purcell and Vivaldi. And then from the northwest, we'll drop down to Hampshire for the first in a series of special concerts from various National Trust properties around the UK. The BBC Singers will join forces with St James's Baroque this afternoon for more Purcell and music by Locke, Turner and Blow. That's our Sunday concert live from the Vine in Hampshire at 2 o'clock this afternoon. But now with the time at 1 o'clock, a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime. It's read by John Shea.
The government is to announce more help this week for groups in Syria which are seeking to force President Assad from power. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said the package of aid would go directly to the opposition and would include more equipment to help save lives. President Assad has told the Sunday Times that he blames Britain for having turned the struggle for power in his country into an armed conflict. He insisted that he would neither step down nor leave for a life in exile. Senior Conservatives have said they won't seek to revive the party's fortunes after coming third in the Eastleigh by-election by adopting policies that appeal to right-wing voters. David Cameron has ruled out such a move. Their coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats, have said they too will resist any move to the right. One of the most senior Islamist militants in North Africa is reported to have been killed in Mali. The Chadian army, which is supporting the French-led intervention against jihadists in the country, said Mokhtar Belmokhtar died in an attack on a base in the north of the country. Voters in Switzerland appear to have backed measures to limit the salaries of top managers. The first projections from the nationwide referendum indicate that 70% of those voting have said yes to the measures. The head of the United Nations Environment Programme has said the poaching of ivory and rhinoceros horn is at its highest level in decades. Achim Steiner was addressing an international meeting in Thailand of CITES, the World Agency for Protecting Endangered Species. A supply ship has arrived at the International Space Station after struggling to dock for several hours. The station's astronauts grabbed the capsule using a robotic arm. The ship is carrying 1 tonne of supplies and 640 seeds for use in research. And the weather. It'll be rather cloudy on the whole across the UK, although the cloud will be fairly thin in many areas, with some sunny spells possible almost anywhere. Tonight, it'll remain largely cloudy and dry. Temperatures will stay above freezing but may fall where clearer skies develop. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02.
John, thank you very much. Well, now, Radio 3, it's time for the Early Music Show. And live from Salford, on stage in Media City, let's join Catherine Bott.
Hello and welcome to BBC Media City in Salford for this special live edition of the Early Music Show to open Radio 3's Baroque spring season. Spring, the sweet spring, is the year's pleasant king. Well, I am cheating a bit with that opener, and I expect people will tell me I am. They'll all write in. Radio 3 listeners are nothing if not learned, but I know I'm ahead of you. It was written by Thomas Nash, who died in 1601, just as the period we now think of as the Baroque was tuning up for the first operas, pan-European music publishing, public concerts, and the invention of the orchestra. Well, Nash missed it all. but he did write one of the best ever poems about the sights and sounds of springtime, and here at Radio 3 we're hoping that Baroque Spring will make everyone want to sing Cuckoo, Jug Jug, Poo Wee, Tuwita Woo. From now until April the 1st, Radio 3 presents a season of music and features designed to shed new light on a period when the likes of Purcell, Handel, Vivaldi and Bach composed some of the best-loved pieces of classical music. I'll tell you more later, but as those four gents happen to be our composers of the week throughout March, the early music show is getting in, well, early, with top period band The English Concert playing live here in the studio. Let's start right away with the Red Priest himself and pretend we're in Venice as we hear Vivaldi's Concerto in B minor for four violins. Thank you.